Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with today's White House visit by the Greek Prime Minister Antonio Samaras, where Obama called for a balance between austerity and growth so the Greek people could see a light at the end of the tunnel. The director of the Center for Hellenic Studies at Simon Fraser University, Andre Gerardimatos, joins us to discuss today's announcement that unemployment in Greece had reached a record 27.6%, with youth unemployment at 60%. Then we'll look into the extent to which the Israeli public is being prepared for a war with Hezbollah, following a briefing yesterday in which senior military officials warned that the next war with Hezbollah could involve up to 100,000 longer-range, more accurate rockets with larger warheads than the 4,000 that rained down on Israel in the 2006 war. Daniel Byman, a professor at the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University and author of A High Price, The Triumphs and Failures of Israel's Counterterrorism, joins us to analyze these latest rumors of another war. Then finally, we'll hear from Background Briefing special correspondent at the 40th ALEC Convention in Chicago, Lauren Windsor, the host and producer of The Undercurrent on the Young Turks Network. Along with most of the press, she was denied access to the secretive meetings between mostly Republican state legislators and the corporate-funded American Legislative Exchange Council, whose model bills like the Stand Your Ground legislation continue to be adopted around the country. We will discuss how the protests outside resonated on the secret meetings taking place on the inside. Joining us now is Andre Gerardimatos, who is the director of the Stavros Niarchos Foundation Center for Hellenic Studies at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, British Columbia, and a specialist in military and diplomatic history. His books on Greek history include Red Acropolis, Black Terror, The Greek Civil War, and his latest book is Castles Made of Sand, A Century of Anglo-American Espionage and Covert Operations in the Middle East. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andre Gerardimatos.
Thank you.
So tell me, what do you expect or imagine went on today at the White House with Prime Minister Antonis Samaras of Greece meeting with President Obama? Just coincidentally, on this day, we find out that Greek unemployment has reached a record high of 27.6%, with almost two-thirds of young people in Greece without a job. So that, I imagine, must have come up in the meeting, right?
Very much so. And I think that Mr. Samaras is looking for, you know, support of any kind at this stage of the game. But, you know, support from the United States, especially President Obama, with the Germans, because the Germans have been insistent upon, you know, cut, austerity, which is not helping the economy really get going. Because, you know, of course, with austerity, people are not making money. They're not spending money.
So what was the, apart from the, what the official statements say, that they talked about the transatlantic trade and investment partnership, what good will that do Greece? I mean, don't they, this austerity that's been rationed out by the EU has clearly crippled their economy, and it's created this record unemployment that we just mentioned. What good is this TTIP partnership going to do for them?
Well, again, I think it has to do with more moral support and the fact that it might encourage American companies and especially Greek Americans to consider investing in Greece, right? And especially if Mr. Samaras can convince these people that the red tape that exists in the country in terms of, you know, preventing businesses from operating has been diminished. Also, I think he wants to impress upon Mr. Obama and Americans in general that Greece is one of the few stable countries in the Eastern Mediterranean. When we look at what's going on in the Middle East in particular, there aren't that many places left that have any kind of political stability in relation to, you know, what is going on in the region.
But my understanding, one of the biggest problems in Greece itself, in as opposed to how much the European Union has been trying to get blood out of a stone here, and that the policies clearly have been wrong-headed and counterproductive, but there's also obviously a lot of blame to be laid, surely, in the way, for example, that the wealthy Greeks don't pay taxes. In fact, an awful lot of people don't pay taxes. So if your government's broke, that's a good place to start, isn't it? Start collecting taxes?
Very much indeed. But I think, you know, you're right. People traditionally have avoided paying taxes. The more money people had, the less taxes they paid in a bizarre way. Part of that is cultural and the fact that, you know, Greece – went through all these wars and all these upheavals, and people had a distrust of the state, and the state gave them back very little, so there was never any inclination to pay taxes. You know, in Canada, you pay your taxes because, you know, your taxes pay for Medicare, they pay for universities, they pay for schools, for roads, for police protection, to the same degree in the United States as well, and of course in Western Europe. But until recently, you know, the Greek state has offered very little in exchange for those taxes. So there's that element. The other is that the tax system itself is a bizarre collection of laws that make it very hard on the average person when they do pay their taxes. I mean, even the EU has commented repeatedly that the Greek taxpayer is one of the most overburdened taxpayers in Europe.
Let me again remind the audience, if I may, that I'm speaking with Andre Gerolimatos, who is the director of the Stavros Niarchos Foundation Center for Hellenic Studies at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, British Columbia. He's a specialist in military and diplomatic history, and his books on Greek history include Rhodocopolis, Black Terror, the Greek Civil War, and the Origins of Soviet-American Rivalry, 1943 to 1949. And his latest book is Castles Made of Sand, A Century of Anglo-American Espionage and Covert Operations in the Middle East. And you made the point earlier, of course, that compared to what's happening in the neighborhood, Greece is relatively stable. Does this mean then, for example, there was a lot of concern about the emergence of a far right-wing party? And of course, on the left, you also have a new emerging party.
Yeah.
Are politics in Greece continuing to polarize with, I think it's New Dawn, right?
And that's right. New Dawn is a kind of a extreme right-wing, neo-fascist sort of party that has achieved some success. But, I mean, in terms of percentages, it's not very high. You know, and it is a reaction to the austerity measures that are going on. I think that would happen in any country, but I don't think that Golden Dawn is going to ever become the government, even or in a coalition government. The other left-wing party, Syriza, which is describes itself as a more revolutionary left-wing party, a more radical left-wing party, is trying very hard to become more of a socialist party. They plan to form a government, and most likely a coalition government. And to do that, they have to become a lot more moderate, you know, closer to the ruling coalition in terms of practices and policies.
So there's been, just in terms of the Prime Minister of Greece, Antonis Samaras, meeting with President Obama today, and just to try to figure out what can be done to reverse Greece's slide. And of course, you know, the Republicans have been using the notion of Greece as a sort of bête noire, you know, in terms of them selling austerity over here in the form of the sky is falling because of these deficits, which were never a problem, but the Republicans have turned them into a problem and used Greece as the poster boy for what could happen to America. And, of course, it's an absurd comparison, but that doesn't mean that they don't make it all the time. So let me just mention a couple of things here. In the recent Pew Research Center survey from March of 2013 found that only 22% in Greece said that Prime Minister Samaras is doing a good job in dealing with the EU economic crisis. So you got a prime minister who's meeting in the White House and only 22% of Greeks think he's doing a good job.
Well, you know, considering one-third of them don't have jobs and the rest of them are living in less than what they had before, I think it would be hard for any prime minister. In fact, it's remarkable that he has 22% under the present circumstances. You know, he's done a remarkable job considering what he has to work with. He surprised a lot of people that he's doing such a good job. He has to make a lot of tough decisions. He's got to live with the European Union, and he's got to live with the Germans. And there's no way around that unless, you know, a country like the United States can morally intervene and kind of help Angela Merkel see the light that development is as effective, you know, along with austerity. You know, the Germans, historically speaking, have a morbid fear of inflation. You know, during the 1930s, their economy went rock bottom, and inflation went through the roof. And as a result, they ended up with the Nazi Party and World War II and all the destruction that came with it. So, you know, they have a kind of a visceral reaction to anything inflationary. Other countries use inflation, they'll print more money to get past a tough period economics and get the economy moving and then, you know, scale back. So these are some of the cultural and some of the political developments that are hampering a Greek recovery.
But the idea of the U.S. being the answer or the solution or coming in on a white horse here, again, in this Pew survey from this year, Greeks express high levels of anti-American sentiment. 39% in Greece expressed a positive view of the United States. This is the worst measure of anti-Americanism, only exceeded by the publics in Turkey, the Palestinian territories, Egypt, Jordan, and Pakistan.
Yeah, so, I'm not surprised. Anti-Americanism has been a factor since 1973 and 1974 because of what happened with Cyprus. And it's become a kind of a cultural phenomenon. I don't quite understand it myself because, you know, I don't live in Greece and I go there and I speak to people. And you ask them, well, what is it about the United States you don't like? They can't really tell you with respect to Greece. They'll tell you, regarding Afghanistan or Iraq or the Palestinian situation. But then you say, well, what does that have to do with Greece? And they really cannot say much. The anti-Americanism, keep in mind, is also a factor of the Eastern Mediterranean. It is very, very powerful in places like Egypt and Syria, as well as Lebanon and Turkey, and, of course, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, and the rest.
So I was mentioning earlier from this poll that only 22% of Greeks said that the Prime Minister, Samaras, is doing a good job, and because he met today at the White House with President Obama. And the Greeks, who were polled by the Pew Research Center in this March 2013 poll, only one-third of Greeks have confidence in the American president to handle international affairs, with 62% expressing little or no confidence. So, I don't mean to rain on their parade.
No, you're not. But you know what? If you do the same poll in Germany and France or England, maybe better in England, but I think on the whole, you're going to find about the same numbers vis-a-vis confidence in President Obama, especially in the light of, you know, what happened with the alert and with the closing down of American embassies, and then there was no terrorist strike, you know. Now, people, of course, can argue in the White House that they did that to prevent a terrorist strike, but from the point of view of people in Europe, they're all poo-pooing the United States as overreacting.
And you're talking about this recent alert.
That's right, yeah. So, you know, depending when you take a poll, right, there's right. What's going on in the world at that moment in time, it will be reflected in the poll.
So again, Andre Gerliamatis, the author of Castles Made of Sand, A Century of Anglo-American Espionage and Covert Operations in the Middle East. He's a professor of Hellenic Studies at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, British Columbia. Let's turn a little bit to the work that you've been doing, because obviously the espionage is high on our radar here with the Snowden affair, which seems to have in part helped scuttle the summit between Putin and Obama in September. Every day there's a new revelation about the National Security Agency here, and there obviously you've been focusing in a lot of your work on espionage in the Middle East. Is there anything below the surface that could be worse than what's above the surface? I don't mean to be facetious, but what do we need to know that's secret there when so much of what is apparent is so appalling?
Well, you know, I think what is below that is probably more appalling. The secret world is secret for a reason. It's not a very nice world. It's a very dirty world. And countries, the intelligence services of countries do not behave like gentlemen. So one should not be surprised if the United States or Great Britain or France or Russia, they take off the gloves, and it's very, very dirty. It's a kind of a war in a fourth dimension where, you know, no holds barred. I mean, the Russians got their hands on Snowden. They're going to give him asylum. But, I mean, in exchange, he has to give them whatever he knows, and I'm sure he will. And that's a major blow, not so much of any current secrets, right? But it's tradecraft. It's how the secrets are collected and how does the agency, the NSA, functions. This is what has the United States so upset.
So, but in terms of the Middle East, what do you think American spies, British spies are doing there, and Iranian spies? I mean, the difference is that the Iranians and the Russians seem to know what they want in Syria. On the Western side, they don't seem to know what they want.
No, they don't. I don't know if the White House is listening to its intelligence community, but certainly the actions of the United States in the Middle East have been confused, to say the least, dangerous, and it's not doing America any good. I mean, initially the White House was very supportive of the Syrian opposition, only to find out that the Syrian opposition was not as lily-white as they thought, that they were as nasty because a lot of elements of al-Qaeda were in the opposition. I think the tendency in North America, and that includes Canada as well as the United States, we want to see good guys and bad guys, black and white. And in the Middle East, that does not exist. It's all shades of gray. And it's very hard for political leaders to explain to the population that it's all shades of gray. So they tend to err on the, black and white. Here are the good guys and here are the bad guys, Assad is the bad guy, the opposition are the good guys. Oops, they're not the good guys anymore. Well, what do we do now,
Well, but just in terms of intelligence, I'm not talking about black operations. I'm talking about political intelligence, which, every day the president gets a briefing. A lot of it's about, the black stuff and the gray stuff. But I talk about the white side here, which is analysis. Who the hell told the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, to go public so early and say that Assad was finished?
I don't think it was the intelligence community. America lacks a very important body, which the British have. You have a lot of intelligence agencies. Last count was 14 in counterintelligence agencies. There is no board, there is no agency that all that information goes into that provides analysis and interpretation that then is passed on to the president. He tends to get it from the different organizations. I mean, you have to feel sorry for the man. I mean, whenever he gets his briefing, he's going to get four or five briefings that may even contradict each other. And then, of course, you have his cabinet who decide to say things because it's politically expedient.
Well, recently the Defense Intelligence Agency leaked a report saying that they were the ones that had told the president from the beginning that Assad was not going to fall, that he was going to last a hell of a lot longer. So somebody was telling Hillary Clinton one thing and the president another.
Well, the State Department has its own kind of intelligence organization, so they collect their own information, and they tend to rely on theirs rather than the CIA or the NSA or the Defense Intelligence. The problem with the United States intelligence community is that it's too big, and it's too many agencies, and it's too much information overload, and that leads to very poor decisions.
So this whole idea of a Director of National Intelligence, this General Clapper, who's recently been caught lying to the Congress, which is not very reassuring. What's his function? I mean, this thing that they have at Tyson's Corner, the Counterterrorism Center, is often been referred to as a massive white elephant. I mean,
It is. They have some like 4,000 people working there and basically doing nothing because the intelligence agencies will not give them any information. They don't trust them with the information. So this was a kind of response to the 9/11 report that, something had to be done, so create another organization. That was the quick and dirty answer, which is sucking a lot of, taxpayers' money for nothing. They'd be better off closing these things down, having, a handful of very good intelligence agencies rather than these gigantic organizations, bringing in masses of information that no one's ever going to use.
Well, but as a result of 9/11 or in response to 9/11, my understanding, and this came out of the Snowden affair, that up to 70% of the U.S. intelligence budget now goes to private contractors.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a massive change. And I talked to a former CIA officer recently who a lot of people, as they leave both the Special Forces and the CIA, they get in touch with him because he's always on CNN and on television over here.
Yeah.
And they're all telling him how much they despise the poaching of the contractors who just grab people because they have security clearance and bump their salaries up, and then they charge that back, tenfold to the taxpayer.
Yeah.
It just feels like this massive boondoggle has taken place since 9/11.
It has indeed. It's terrorism, the war against terror has become an industry, and a lot of companies are feeding off that industry and have become very rich doing so. I mean, 70% is a huge number. Meanwhile, more intelligence organizations are created. And what are they for? And if they're going to go private, I mean, that's a huge mistake in the first place, because giving this to private companies, no matter how high their clearance is, they're private companies. They're working for a dollar. They're not working for their country.
So just in closing then, Andre Gerolimatos, we got away from Greece into your specialty, which is the history of intelligence, and particularly in the Middle East, and the Soviet-American rivalry in Greece, which of course began in 1949. That was the beginning of the Cold War, wasn't it? That was literally the first front in the Cold War, was it not?
Yeah, the Greek Civil War was a kind of a first clash between the Soviet Union and the United States. And it's interesting. It's a war that the United States won, and won very well. And yet all the wrong lessons were drawn from it for future conflicts.
Meaning what?
Vietnam. Right? I mean, if you look at some of the documentation, that some of the reasoning about Vietnam, they always hark back to the success that they had in Greece. But a very important difference is that the United States sent advisors, sent materiel, sent soldiers to advise Greek soldiers, but they never sent American troops on the ground to take part in the Greek Civil War, as happened in Vietnam.
So what we were just saying earlier from that poll that the Pew Research Center just conducted back in May of this year, of how incredibly unpopular the United States is in Greece.
But it wasn't always the case. You know, when I was a kid in Greece, America was the most beloved country. It was the most popular country. Up until the Turkish invasion of Cyprus, a lot of people convinced themselves that the United States had a role to play in favor of Turkey with the invasion of Cyprus, and they're still convinced by that.
Because the U.S. let it happen, right? I mean, it caught everybody by surprise.
It did.
In fact, you know, that is one of the rare occasions where nuclear weapons fell into the wrong hands, although it turns out that the Turks didn't realize they had it. They overran a British base in which there were bunkers with nuclear bombs, and it's one of those broken arrow incidents that nobody talks about.
Exactly. Very, very true. But, I mean, to set the record straight, I don't think the United States intervened in favor of Turkey. You're right. They simply did not intervene to stop Turkey, and that has been misunderstood as intervention on behalf of Turkey.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Andre.
You're very welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with Andre Gerolimatos, who is the director of the Stavros Niarchos Foundation Center for Hellenic Studies at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, British Columbia, and a specialist on military and diplomatic history. His books on Greek history include Red Acropolis, Black Terror, The Greek Civil War, and The Origins of Soviet-American Rivalry, 1943 to 1949. And his latest book is Castles Made of Sand, A Century of Anglo-American Espionage and Covert Operations in the Middle East. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about how the Israeli public appear to be being prepared for a war with Hezbollah. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Daniel Byman, who's a professor at the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University and a senior fellow at the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He served on the 9/11 Commission staff and is the author of A High Price, The Triumphs and Failures of Israeli Counterterrorism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daniel Byman.
Thank you for having me.
And yesterday there was a high-level briefing of a number of reporters in Israel where military officials talked about how the next war with Hezbollah could be so much worse than the 2006 Lebanese war, where 4,000 rockets were fired onto Israel, killing 40 civilians. This time around, they're talking about 60,000 to 100,000 rockets with longer ranges, greater accuracy, and much bigger warheads. And this has been described as a whole new ball game, according to the official that briefed the reporters. What's going on in Israel? Are the public being prepared for another war with Hezbollah?
The public is being prepared in a general sense. Since the very, very bloody and destructive 2006 war, the border between Lebanon and Israel has been surprisingly quiet, perhaps the quietest it's been in decades. And as a result, there's a sense among the Israeli public that this problem is diminished. And I think given the turmoil in Syria and the turmoil in Lebanon, the Israeli government wants to make sure the public is not only vigilant, but is not getting a false sense of security.
Well, what about this Iron Dome weapon system? 60 Minutes did a piece making it sound like it was the perfect weapon system. And of course, we've had a lot of skepticism over the years about the anti-ballistic missile system, and we spent zillions on trying to intercept, you know, as they say, to hit a bullet with a bullet. It's not technically not a very easy thing to accomplish. What's your understanding on Iron Dome? Because apparently, if there is an attack from Hezbollah with up to 100,000 rockets raining down on Israel, apparently Iron Dome is hardly sufficient, even if it works as well as, say, the 60 Minutes piece indicated.
That's right. Iron Dome can certainly handle, at least to some degree, limited or isolated attacks, but you can't overwhelm the system. The problem for Hezbollah is that if it tries to do massive attacks, that requires a lot of time. And if they're fighting Israel, if Israel's air force is flying over Lebanon, if Israel's artillery itself is ready, it's unclear if Hezbollah will have lots of time to prepare attacks and to launch them continually. So Iron Dome may prove effective or at least diminish some of the impact of Hezbollah, but certainly Israelis should not count on it.
So in the context of what's going on next door, where you have a, well, not right next door, but just to the north of Lebanon, you have a country literally being torn apart and bleeding terribly, and there doesn't seem to be any end in sight. And there have been a number of Israeli strikes against Hezbollah convoys, allegedly bringing in sophisticated weaponry. And there was a more recent attack on July the 5th that got little to no publicity, and the only publicity it got was here in the United States, which apparently upset a lot of people in Israel who they don't want to put their signature on these strikes. And this was apparently in the port of Latakia, where a bunch of advanced anti-ship missiles were destroyed, but apparently not all of them. So what is the game that Israel is playing here? Obviously, it would seem to me that if they were to turn the Syrian civil war into an Arab-Israeli war, that would be a gift to Assad, would it not?
Certainly, and Israel is trying to avoid it. Part of the reason for the relative silence on the Israeli side is, even as they're doing strikes, they don't want to become the news story. For Israel, what they're concerned about is that the chaos of war will lead weapons to go from Syria to Hezbollah, including chemical weapons and more advanced surface-to-air missiles, for example. And they're also concerned that Iran is going to step up transfers. So they're trying to stop these, but at the same time, stay out of the headlines.
So what do you make of this theory that floated by some analysts that the strategy, if indeed we do have a strategy, there always seems to have been a lot of ambivalence on the part of the West about what to do in Syria, you know, in contrast to the Iranians and the Russians who seem to be, and Hezbollah, who seem to be quite focused and know exactly what they want and are supporting Assad to the hilt. There's obviously been some ambivalence on the Western side, but I don't know that that's a strategy, which is, you know, to have them bleed each other to the point of exhaustion and then maybe there's some kind of peace deal can be made. But this other strategy that was suggested the other day was that there could be an attempt to turn Syria into Iran's Vietnam. In other words, they get sucked in with men, materiel, and particularly with money, because my understanding is that the Syrian economy is just flat broke, and without subsidies from Iran, Assad would have gone under a while back. So what do you make of that theory?
The Syrian conflict has been a real problem for Iran, and I would say so in two ways. First, the Syria conflict has really hurt Iran's credibility in the broader Muslim world. Iran for years had played up the idea that it was standing up to the United States, it was standing up to Israel, and now it's seen as backing a almost genocidal government that's slaughtering Sunni Muslims. So it's really damaged Iran's reputation. Also, Iran is propping up Syria financially, as you mentioned, and Iran itself is under huge financial strain. The sanctions that the Obama administration has orchestrated are really biting deep. So Iran doesn't have much money to spare, and Syria needs a lot. The Vietnam analogy doesn't quite work in terms of casualties, because while Iran does have some forces in Syria, it's not huge numbers. It's not comparable in any way to U.S. deployments in Vietnam or later on in Iraq. But this is a conflict that is causing problems for Iran, even though Tehran sees it as vital to shore up an ally.
Again, I'm speaking with Daniel Barman, who's a professor at the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University and senior fellow at the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He served on the 9/11 Commission staff and is the author of A High Price, The Triumph and Failures of Israeli Counterterrorism. So a lot of analysts have told me that the 2006 war, as far as the Israeli generals are concerned, it's not over. I know there was a lot of bitterness after that war. There were recriminations. There was an investigation. I believe it didn't lead to the downfall of Prime Minister Olmert, didn't it?
It certainly contributed. It was mainly personal corruption, but the war was a blow to his prestige and his handling of Israel in general.
So the question is there a constituency in the Israeli military that would like to have a second crack at Hezbollah?
There's a constituency in the Israeli military that sees Hezbollah as an arm of Iran, and Israel is concerned, even obsessed to some degree, over the Iranian threat. I think most Israeli military leaders have a fairly healthy respect for Hezbollah and aren't particularly eager to have another round. It's more a question of whether they see it as inevitable. And in particular, when you think of the confrontation over Iran's nuclear program, if the U.S. strikes, if Israel strikes, there's an expectation that Hezbollah, on behalf of Iran, will strike Israel. So the question then becomes, if we're going to go down this road, would Israel strike Hezbollah first in the hope of preempting and avoiding a lot of the damage Hezbollah would otherwise do?
So if then an attack on Hezbollah is a precursor to any attack on Iran, because Hezbollah is Iran's means to retaliate, how do you rate the situation vis-a-vis Iran and Israel at the moment? I mean, there's been lots and lots of rumors of war, talks of war for the longest time now. There is a new Iranian leader. What's your sense then of where things stand?
There have been talk of war for really over 5 years now, and everyone seems to say that, you know, this year will be decisive. So it's always unclear to me, you know, exactly when we're going to see a firm decision one way or another. But certainly Israel wants to keep this option open, and it's hoping that at least the threat of this option will make the United States be more successful in its economic and diplomatic campaign at the very least. But I think some people believe Israel's window has really passed, that the best time for Israel to have done this was a year or two ago, and it'll be less effective than it would be if it did so today. But this is something that is a political as well as strategic question. The Prime Minister of Israel has campaigned on the idea that he will not let Iran go nuclear. And so as Iran gets closer and closer to this, this raises the question of his own credibility as well as a threat to Israel.
So what is going on then with these peace talks? Are they in any way a response to the broader tensions in the neighborhood, the growing sectarian split within Islam between Shia and Sunnism, which is manifested in the proxy war in Syria? Iraq is extremely fragile, and that domino could fall or be ignited by the war next door in Iran. And there's been some major shifts in the political alliances now with the downfall of the Muslim Brotherhood government in Egypt. My understanding is that Hamas is quite vulnerable now, and the Egyptians have just closed the border with Gaza, and they're going to seal that up. So is there a possibility that the outside shifts in the geopolitical landscape are prompting the Israelis and the Palestinian authorities to try and get serious?
The safe answer is no. We all hope that so. But in general, the insecurity and the uncertainty of the external environment, I think, has made both sides more cautious. that on the Palestinian side, there's a sense that they're not sure they'll have backing from neighboring Arab states, which they've always seen as essential. And there's a real division between Hamas and the Palestinian Authority that shows no sign of being bridged. On the Israeli side, I think they're concerned that any government they make peace with in the West Bank might disappear tomorrow. They're afraid that the instability in Syria, the instability elsewhere in the region, could spread to a new Palestinian state. So they're very concerned that their negotiating partner is politically weak. And as a result, I think they'll move very slowly if they can.
Well, some of the reports, though, about Gaza and about Hamas following the downfall of the Muslim Brotherhood, which was obviously a major sponsor. Hamas was originally sprung out of the Muslim Brotherhood. The reports indicate that the people in Gaza are obviously absolutely fed up, and they've been living under hideous conditions for the longest time, and they're not happy with this very rigid religious government. I mean, the idea of the Israelis making a peace with the Palestinians is absurd on the surface, isn't it? Because which Palestinians are we talking about here? So is there any chance that you'll end up with a real Palestinian side to talk to? In other words, a united Palestinian side?
In the near term, there seems to be little chance. As you mentioned, Hamas's loss of the Muslim Brotherhood government is seen as a huge blow. And as a result, the Hamas faction in the West Bank sees little need to make a deal. That now that their ascendant, now that their allies are winning elsewhere, why bother to make a deal and let Hamas in the door, if you would? And as a result, the Palestinians don't speak with one voice. And it's so easy for Hamas to criticize any concessions, let alone the big ones that would be necessary for peace. And in addition, if Hamas starts to launch rocket attacks on Israel or otherwise stirs the pot, it's going to be very hard to have negotiations on both the Israeli and on the moderate Palestinian side.
So what are these talks about then? Is this about the process as opposed to peace itself?
Well, there's always hope that this will be talks about peace itself. As you could tell, I'm skeptical of this, but I do think it's worth trying. The odds might be very low, but maybe you can get something moving. Maybe the external environment will shift for the better. Maybe there'll be changes politically among the Palestinians or among the Israelis that make the governments more favorable to peace talks. To me, it's worth trying, even though there's a good chance it's going to fail.
So we started out talking about the briefing that took place yesterday by senior military officials and briefing the foreign press and the local press in Israel about the possibility of Hezbollah raining down up to 100,000 much longer range, more accurate, and with larger warheads, missiles than were rained down on Israel, some 4,000 back in 2006. And we recall that that was pretty traumatic. So you have some sort of preparation, both, I guess, psychological and physical in terms of bomb shelters. But it's still, as far as I know, I mean, at least one-third of the population doesn't have bomb shelters. So how serious is this briefing yesterday, do you think, in terms of preparing the Israeli public for something?
I think it's certainly serious in the sense that the Israeli government's threat perception is that things are going to get worse, not better. That Lebanon, which has been calm for a while, is becoming less stable. That Hezbollah, which has been deterred by Israel for a while, may be becoming bolder. That the Syrian border in particular and the Golan, there may be jihadists or others across the border that are going to open up a new front against Israel. So to me, this is a reaction against the uncertainty and the genuine fear in Israeli strategic circles, and they want to make sure the public is prepared for what might come down the road.
Well, just in closing, it does seem that the other border in the south, the border with Egypt, is the one where there is activity that you haven't had. You haven't had military clashes on that border since Camp David, and now they're starting to happen. And Israel just closed its airport at Eilat in the Sinai because of undisclosed security assessments. My understanding is that the Sinai itself is becoming something of a no man's land, that there is tremendous infiltration of jihadis coming in there from all around the world, and it's a security vacuum. And as long as the Egyptian military are tied up with the street protests and with this unstable political situation in Egypt, one wonders whether or not they're going to be able to deal with this situation. So Is it possible that here we are having a discussion about Israel perhaps preparing for a war with Hezbollah in Lebanon, and yet you've got this new front opening up in the south?
Israelis are very concerned about instability in the Sinai. As you mentioned, this has gone from a non-problem to a minor problem to a major problem. We've seen cross-border attacks on Israel. We've seen attacks on the pipeline going to and from Egypt and Israel. And there's concern that weapons from Libya have spread to the Sinai, perhaps including surface-to-air missiles. So Israelis are very concerned about this. Their hope is that, especially with a military-led government in Egypt now, that there'll be a greater effort on the Egyptian part to go after the rebels in the Sinai. Israelis are not eager to do their own operations there. They're afraid that it will only make things worse. So the belief is that by better defenses, by encouraging the government of Egypt, and in part by just sucking it up, Israel can weather that storm.
Well, Daniel Bierman, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Daniel Bierman, who's a professor at the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University and a senior fellow at the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He served on the 9/11 Commission staff and is the author of A High Price, The Triumph and Failures of Israeli Counterterrorism. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back and go to Chicago for an update on the ALEC conference. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Lauren Windsor, who is a multimedia journalist who blogs under the name Lady Libertine. She's also the host and producer of The Undercurrent, a grassroots political TV web show on the Young Turks Network. And she's also a correspondent for Background Briefing, covering the 40th ALEC conference in Chicago. Welcome, roving reporter. How are you doing there?
Oh, I'm good. It's been crazy.
So the credentials that we prepared for you from Background Briefing for KPFK, I take it they didn't impress the ALEC people?
No, they didn't. I went to directly to the media registration, and when I got there and said Background Briefing, they looked at me with a kind of puzzled face, and I had registered online prior to going. I didn't get a confirmation on that. But on the website for ALEC, it said media may register in advance online, but regardless, they'll have to go through the application process on site. So I brought that up. I brought that to their attention, and they didn't seem very concerned about it. I spoke with Director of Public Relations for ALEC, Bill Meyerling, and I had emailed him. I said, I applied early. You didn't send me a reply, but I assumed that was because I was going to have to register on site as per the website. And he was like, well, registration closed a week ago, and we only opened it to media outlets that were local to Chicago.
Well, I'm devastated. I thought my name would do the trick, and
so did I.
Furthermore, they may think that KPFK is a left-wing operation, but I'm considered the resident right-winger here. I'm the agent of the CIA. Why didn't you tell them that?
Well, I presented them with a letter requesting the press credentials, the one that you signed for me. And I think that the Pacifica masthead on the letter was probably the death knell for my ability to get in as a credentialed journalist.
I see.
But
Well, yes, because we give right-wing people equal time here, but I guess they don't, they're not aware of it.
Well, I tried to explain that
I'm
to
kidding.
Them, and, you know, I can have you speak with Ian, or I can have you speak with the station manager, and, you know, we present a news program that's in-depth analysis of domestic and foreign affairs from experts, from policy experts. And he was not impressed. He was not swayed whatsoever. So I've been trying to glean whatever information I can from, you know, being in the public areas of the hotel. It's been hard, though, because there was a big protest today from several labor groups.
Well, tell us about that, Lauren Windsor, again, a multimedia journalist who blogs under the name Lady Libertine. She's also the host and producer of The Undercurrent, a grassroots political TV web show on the Young Turks Network. And she's also Background Briefing's correspondent covering the 40th ALEC conference in Chicago. So tell us about the demonstrations that took place. My understanding is that there were a number of arrests as well, and that people were wearing hoodies in reference to Trayvon Martin, because ALEC, of course, are famous for pushing this model law around the country known as Stand Your Ground.
Yes, so their trademark legislation that they've come under fire for, and that's really raised their notoriety, has been the Stand Your Ground laws, but also the voter ID laws in various states that are, you know, requiring voters to show ID. So in those states, you know, they're saying that this is an attempt at voter suppression. The protest today had about 2,700 people. That was a Chicago Police Department estimate. They had the street in front of the hotel blocked off. They had set up a stage. The various labor unions, IBEW, AFL-CIO, Teamsters. And then towards the end of the protest, I believe the number is five. It was five protesters that were arrested.
So what was the idea of getting a message to this incredibly secretive group that are meeting in this hotel that apparently, you know, you weren't the only person who couldn't get in? I don't think they'd let any press in unless they were, I don't know how far to the right you have to be to get let in. But my understanding is that it's a highly secretive operation. So
it is highly secretive, and even those that are credentialed, the very few that they've credentialed, only have access to certain panels. So, like, the task force workshops are closed to the public, and those are the meetings where they have these in-depth policy discussions where they're introducing model legislation.
And to largely Republican state legislatures.
It is. I was able to get one of the books, and, you know, when you go through the ALEC alumni, even, like, listed within their book for Congress, I think it was all Republicans and one Democrat. The Democrat was Joe Manchin.
Mm-hmm. The senator from West Virginia.
Senator, yeah, right. From West Virginia. So this is all state legislators, state senators, state congressmen, and they're pushing these various bills. I mean, you can see the ALEC imprint on so many of these different national Republican, like, right-wing initiatives for, you know, rolling back abortion rights, for requiring voter ID. But there's also legislation that pushes the use of coal. So the American Petroleum Institute is here, the various coal groups throughout, like, Ohio. I spoke with some of the representatives from the Ohio Coal Association last night.
So
they were explaining to me the virtues of clean coal,
which is a myth, and if it does exist, it's only because of government research, and the coal industry has not put a dime into clean coal research, but they keep saying it exists when it's entirely theoretical. So that must have been a fascinating conversation.
Oh, it was. They told me that 95% of the smoke that comes out of smokestacks is water vapor. It's like, well, they were telling me, like, well, will somebody please tell the Sierra Club? It's not smoke, it's water vapor. But it wasn't a very convincing argument.
So, but I'm trying to get a sense, though, Lauren Windsor, of whether or not the people, these Republican legislators that have come to this 40th ALEC anniversary, and ALEC has been funded by major, major corporations. But when their existence was exposed in 2011 and there was a leak of all of their a lot of their model legislation. A considerable amount of documents were given to the Center for Media and Democracy. Since they were exposed, 49 major corporations, including Walmart, Bank of America, and General Motors, broke off their affiliation with ALEC. So you would think that somebody within ALEC would get the message that people are trying to smoke them out, and when you expose them to the sunlight, it doesn't look too good.
No, it doesn't. Effort on the part of ALEC at Damage Control in June, they sent a letter to membership saying that only legislators would be able to introduce model legislation for the group. I mean, it still is a collaborative effort between parties. So there's the public sector members and the private sector members. But previously, you know, the business leaders had been able to bring forth legislation. Supposedly, according to this email that Politico obtained, they're only allowing legislators to introduce the bills. I don't know what real effect that will have on their process for introducing legislation. I think it's kind of a nominal, superficial gesture.
But as far as I know, that even since the Center for Media and Democracy exposed them, they still are alive and well. They're having their 40th meeting in Chicago, which you're covering, and no fewer than 62 Stand Your Ground and voter ID laws have been introduced so far this year based on these model bills framed by ALEC, and that's 10 Stand Your Ground bills passed in two states and 52 legislative moves to restrict voter access adopted by five states. So they're not out of business by any means.
Oh, no, they're not. The groups that you had mentioned earlier, some of them, the corporate members that had quit. According to the Center for Media and Democracy, 55 of the corporations that were part of ALEC didn't renew their subscription or their membership up to June of this year. So most current numbers, they've lost 55 members up to June. That doesn't mean that they're out of business by any means, though.
Well, who's left, though? I mean, talk about naming and shaming. You'd think that, because my understanding is big companies like Verizon are still involved.
Some of the ones that have left, like the really high-profile ones were like Coca-Cola, Wells Fargo, Merck, Sprint, but they still have a number of corporations and legislatures.
Well, give me a sense of the big names that are still there that can be named and shamed, because I'm always amazed that so many people on the political left, you know, see the Koch brothers as these huge boogeymen, which I think they are, but yet people still buy Bounty paper towels and Dixie cups and Georgia Pacific.
Biggest sponsor is Reynolds American. So big tobacco. That's at the president level of sponsorship. There's, I believe, four different tiers. So at the president level, you have Reynolds American. At the chairman level, you have K-12, Peabody Energy, How Money Walks, the U.S. Chamber Institute for Legal Reform, the American Coalition for Clean Coal Electricity, ExxonMobil, the Cigar Association of America, SPN. At the vice chairman level, you have Celgene, BNSF Railway, Pharma, UPS, and the Illinois Policy Institute. At the director level, you have Cloud Peak Energy, CenturyLink, Takeda, TransCanada. So listeners out there should be familiar with TransCanada as the ones pushing the construction of the Keystone XL pipeline.
Well, it sounds like the list that you've gotten a who's who of the polluting industries.
They are. There's others like Wells Fargo and Eli Lilly, the Illinois Chamber of Commerce, that are they're actually at the trustee level. So I think that perhaps some of these corporations that may have had a larger stake in membership, a larger contribution, have scaled back their involvement.
But still, the group is alive and well, and even though it was founded in 1973, it's done an awful lot of damage. It remained under the radar for so long and was only recently exposed, and it's still having its 40th get-together, and 466 ALEC bills have been introduced by state legislatures so far this year, spanning all 50 states as well as the District of Columbia. So just in closing, give us a sense of what happened on the street and who's paying attention.
Labor really came out in force for this. Their problem is that ALEC has pushed bills to keep wages artificially low. One of the biggest things is the right to work. So pushing the national right to work bills across the state. That was really brought to a head by Scott Walker, if you'll remember, back in Madison. And that was at the behest, really, of the model legislation from ALEC for the right to work. Unions know that ALEC is anti-union, and that's why they showed out in force today. But inside, you wouldn't be able to tell that it had any effect, aside from the enhanced security. So it was virtually impossible to move around on any of the floors without having security guard ask you who you were, where you were going, what you were doing there.
And you're staying at the actual hotel where all the legislators are staying, and the ALEC people, right?
Yeah.
And still you couldn't slip in and flutter your eyelids and whatever else you do?
No, not quite. Okay. I've been talking to people, though, in the public spaces, and there's just really a dismissive tone to the concerns of the protesters. They really do believe, these members of ALEC, believe that what they're doing is in the advancement of legislation to create a friendlier business environment. Their whole mantra is limited government, free markets, and federalism. They think they're advancing those objectives with what they're doing, and they think that it's, oh, well, we introduce this legislation in the public, all becomes public, it has to go through committee and move through the state houses. So people have the opportunity to amend it as they see fit, and if they're not taking part in that process, then that's not our fault. We're above board in that respect.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Lauren Windsor.
Thank you, Ann.
Again, I've been speaking with Lauren Windsor, who's a multimedia journalist who blogs under the name Lady Libertine. She's also the host and producer of The Undercurrent, a grassroots political TV web show on the Young Turks Network. And she is Background Briefing's special correspondent on the site of the 40th ALEC conference in Chicago, where she was denied entrance in spite of presenting them with credentials signed by me. So I'm still devastated. Thanks again, Lauren.
You're helping.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Claire Goldsmith. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.